community, plus a major pro-life event taking place in the Midwest. And Gail Buckley is starting us off right with our scripture verse for the week.
Catholic Connection, weekday mornings at 8 a.m. on 990 WDEO.
Radio for Catholic and other Christians. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
My guest is Paul Costello, who is from Australia, but living in the United States. He's the executive director of the Center for Narrative Studies, which he founded, which deals with world conflict, places like Northern Ireland and the Holy Land, with something called narrative therapy. It relies on some insights that have been forthcoming for several decades regarding the importance of how we tell our story about ourselves and how these stories can lead us into ongoing conflict and how changing those stories can sometimes provide some sort of at least opportunity of resolving them. Paul Costello has worked on a program regarding Northern Ireland from 1998 to 2008, and when he finished that, he did receive public recognition from the Congress of the United States and the Northern Ireland Assembly. But since 2009, he's been trying to apply some of the same methods, narrative methods, to the Middle East and has created a program called New Story Leadership for young Palestinian and Israeli students. I've asked him to come on the show because we have such a unfortunate outbreak of conflict between Israel and Gaza in this case. And I want to talk a lot about how he has experienced reconciliation in the past or helped to facilitate it and what he thinks can be done in a area of the world that seems to have no solution. Paul Costello, thanks for coming on Church and Culture.
Thank you, Deal. My pleasure to have this conversation with you. Thank you very much.
Well, I guess we should start with, you know, for many, many decades, or really for nearly a century, I guess, people have considered Northern Ireland, their conflict between Northern Ireland and the British, between Protestant and Catholic, something irresolvable. But yet we've seen, through work like yours, we've actually seen some serious progress there. Am I right? Is there serious progress? And if so, what happened to make that possible?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a fascinating case study that I always look back to in the work, in the current work with the Israeli-Palestinian young people, because I think, you know, one of my gurus that I inspired by is James Hillman, who's a sort of Jungian psychologist. And James Hillman
relied a great deal on the work of the Renaissance philosopher Marsilio Ficino.
Absolutely. And, I mean, he said, you know, wars begin in the imagination when you start to imagine the other as your enemy. And I think on the same boat that peace begins in the imagination when you can reimagine your enemy as a human being and as somebody who sort of connected and has shared interests to you. I think that's kind of what happened in Northern Ireland, in the sense that at one point, I think it reached a point where they were sick of the bloodshed on both sides. I think there was some dramatic interventions from the mothers of the deceased, from the women's coalition. I think women played a huge role in having their voices heard. And then I think the younger generation kind of grew up seeing that the future was far more exciting than the past.
And was there a turning point in Northern Ireland where they started imagining peace?
Well, I think it's kind of almost Shakespearean. I started my work with them in 1998, and it was the Good Friday Agreement that Senator George Mitchell kind of brokered,
right,
with the support of President Clinton, and you know, talking to the so-called terrorist groups then, you know, bringing them into the conversation, and then at the end of the program that summer, the Omar bomb went off, and it was like the worst possible atrocity of all the years of the Troubles. So I think, you know, I think the decision, and maybe it's applicable maybe to Gaza, when you've got to get to a crisis point, and then you make your decision, and like, as we say in the biblical terms, you know, the chronos becomes a kairos. This is a moment right. of faith. I think the Omar bombing... it was so much revulsion, and especially there were young...
remind us of that bomb. Remind us of what happened.
In August of 1998, so like there was jubilation in early in the year with the Good Friday Agreement that the parties had finally come to the table and were going to have a shared government together. And then in August, the sort of the real IRA or the continuing IRA, some of the dissidents who just didn't want the peace to happen, planted some bombs in the main street of Omar. And in my team at my class at the time, there were two or three young people from Omar that I was sort of taking care of in New York. And they did call ahead to say, you know, there's a bomb in town and ask people to sort of clear out. But they gave them the wrong directions. And instead of the people moving away from the bomb, they moved into the space of the bomb. So 33 people were killed. So I think, you know, at a moment of extreme pain, it's a pivot point in the story where people kind of, when they step back a little bit from their grief, then decide, well, how much more of this can we take?
Is it a stepping back from the grief or from the hatred or both?
I think it's both. I mean, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous have this wonderful narrative thing, I think, which is like you've got to hit rock bottom before
Or you've got to admit you're at rock bottom.
Well, exactly. And then I think when you see the carnage or when maybe even grief overwhelms the hatred somehow.
I'm talking with Paul Costello, who uses narrative therapy to deal with a world conflict, and having worked a decade in Northern Ireland, recently turned his attention to what I think is an even tougher nut to crack, and that is the ongoing struggles between Israel and its occupied territories, in his case, Gaza. Now, Paul, if I say a tougher nut to crack, what I mean is that the conflict there is, which really goes back to 1946, when Nation of Israel was established by United Nations fiat by decision, and immediately when Jews began to arrive in the region of Palestine, which they know as Israel, and a conflict immediately started because the Arab population there and the Christian population, which was a lot bigger at the time, did not welcome their land simply being given away by an international body of which they were not a member.
Right.
So we have now here a 60 or 70 year old problem, which frankly is not as old as the Northern Ireland problem was that you were dealing with.
Yeah.
So maybe it just needs more time. What's your view?
I think that what we say is that, you know, if you want to change the world, you have to change the story. And the first story that you have to change is the story that says you can't change anything. So I think that, you know, the whole conflict, any conflict is a story system or even a story game, and certain meanings have to be created, certain characters have to be scripted, certain plot points have to happen if you're going to sustain a war system that actually is going to justify taking people's lives and homes and destroying their future. So it's a massive sort of hermeneutical task or meaning.
By the way, by hermeneutic, we just mean interpretive task.
Yeah, making meaning all the time. I mean, if people are killed, what does that mean? And then if you can say, well, if they're martyrs, that maybe sort of assuages the grief, or if they're patriots. But it's a huge challenge to keep making meaning sufficient enough to justify the destruction of the basic things that make human life worthwhile. So I think in an analyzing... You know, so one of the things we do is working with young people who were in their 20s who have a lot more future ahead of them than the past.
So you've been doing this since 2009.
With Israel and Palestine, yeah.
Now, so you've got a lot of data. on your belt?
Well, we have. I mean, visits to the region, recruiting, interviewing, selecting, and stuff in Israel.
How much openness are you finding on both sides?
Well, I think up until the war, I thought, you know, with the peace initiative being announced this time last year, I thought the tides of history were starting to turn. But I think war kind of creates, the news story comes back with a vengeance when a war is happening. So my young people here, it was a very difficult summer. One of them was from Gaza. One of them was from a refugee camp. All the Israeli young people, if they were back in Israel, they would have been called up. And some of them could well have been fighting in Gaza. So it just...
So you... Well, let me sort of slow that, what you said, down a little bit.
Right.
So you were working with young adults from Israel, Palestine, including Gaza.
Right.
At the very time this conflict broke out over the deaths of three Israeli...
Right.
Young people in the region of Hebron.
Right.
You were with them.
Right.
Tell us a little bit more about how the old story kind of, as you say, came back with a vengeance.
I think it's fascinating. I mean, one of the young people was from a place called Dura, just outside of Hebron. He said if he hadn't left the day he left, if he'd delayed it by a day, he wouldn't have got out because the burned-out car that they found that had the teenagers, that they thought the teenagers were carried in, was found in Dura. So that happened like the day before the program began.
He was Palestinian?
And he was Palestinian.
So that city would have been completely surrounded.
It would have been
locked down.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And then, you know, people, the security went in there. There was some shooting and some there were some casualties. So, I mean, the first 2 weeks of the summer, I mean, things, we're not a program that, we kind of challenged the notion that the conflict is the only story that these young people can attach their identity to. So this week or two was great. They got to know each other, shared their personal stories. We got into the...
How many young adults were involved?
We take 10, deal. We take okay. 5 Israelis and 5...
I don't blame you for keeping it small.
Because
you've got a lot of issues to deal with.
With the program, we used to take 30, 35. But with this program, it's just 10. But after about week two, when things started to unravel, then it became very, very difficult for the team. The young lady from Gaza was calling every day, every morning, to find out whether her mum and dad were still alive. The Israeli young people were checking with their friends who have been called up and in service. So some of them were sort of living a bifurcated life. They were half here and they were half at home. Yet,
now, are they still with you?
Some of them have gone home this week. The program finished officially on Sunday after 7 weeks. But I mean, as I say to them, you know, they had their own war here, but they managed to stay engaged. They managed to stay at the table. Some deep friendships were formed between Israelis and Palestinians that I think will endure even through something like this war. And I think that, you know, they got to experience the war through the eyes of the other. And that would not have happened back home. So,
did the other stay the other?
The other sort of, I think it was a difficult way to build a bridge. I think some of them were a little bit more mature than others, and some of them were sort of very much lost in their pain. But the program creates a sort of container or a structure where they feel safe and they feel secure and they feel loved. And, you know, I mean, these are young adults, they're not kids, so it's a pretty, you know, it's not like running a high school. We pay tribute to their resilience to sort of deal.
Well, they grow up faster over there.
They absolutely do. And they absolutely do. I mean, the thing that the young people were doing here, and it's an important part of our method, is that, you know, people from war zones feel like victims, and they not only feel like victims, they tell victims stories which make them feel they have no agency. So, I mean, this program is about empowering the young people to give witness, authentic witness, before members of Congress, before the academic and diplomatic communities and the faith communities. I mean, they speak before a trinity of communities of a Christian church, a synagogue, and a mosque. And they witness their story and their hopes. So all through their summer, they were kind of advocates for the suffering of their peoples and the hopes of their people to an American audience that was kind of saturated with CNN and MSNBC and Fox News that were sort of blaring and screaming and yelling and sort of feeding the partisan sort of kind of aggression that was going on.
I'm talking with Paul Costello, by the way, about his work with the conflict between Israel and Palestine and working specifically with young adults from both sides in programs that deal directly with their self-described narratives and how those narratives bring them in and keep them in conflict. I'm not surprised that you saw a kind of hardening of attitudes toward each other, because as you've said so well, I mean, the old story comes back with a vengeance. I mean, the moment you have young Israelis die and you have any kind of rocket come from Gaza, immediately the old story about Hamas being a terrorist group, Hamas denying the existence of Israel, Hamas this, Hamas that, and it all becomes just a totally irresolvable set of directly opposing stories, correct?
Right. Well, it pushes them back into that sort of shadow story where it's that primal fear, that that blots out any awareness of the other, except as constructed as the enemy, as the hostile one who's a threat.
As the villain,
you see. And then the biology takes over and the biography gets a little bit lost. But I have to say to these young people, though, that they really stood in that hard place without becoming hard-hearted. And, as they listen to each other's stories, and the process we use is these big public speaking events. We call them leadership moments. So they get their prime time, a keynote address before an important audience in Washington, but they don't do it individually. I mean, every speech is workshopped by the whole team. So if the Israelis are going to get up and say things about the Palestinians, they can't objectify them because the Palestinians are there.
And they're sitting right there.
They're sitting right there, and vice versa. So there's a feedback loop by which they get a sense of what is the listening that they're creating. And I think, you know, it's a big part of our program. It's not what you say that really matters, it's what gets heard. And you know, what do you want people to listen to you or get mad at you?
Did you find that any part of the opposing narrative began to weaken as they spoke to each other? Was there anything specific that they gave up, so to speak, to get closer to the other side?
Well, I think some of the young Israelis who had some experience in the military and kind of knew.
Well, there's required military service.
There is, but some of them, I guess, you know, some of them had a more, I suppose, you know, they were more at the aggressive end of that than others. But, you know, I saw attempts on both sides where they were trying to invite, whether they were wanting to the other person to hear that they got their story about what it was like to be living in Gaza, or that everybody in Gaza is not Hamas, or that, you know, 50% of the people in Gaza are under the ages of 18, and most of them, 70% are women and children. So, like, if it's your mother and your father and your sister and your brother, and that's the person sitting beside you at the same work desk. So, I mean, you know, we had a former IDF soldier and a young woman from Gaza working every day in a congressman's office. And, you know, they said they spent probably more time outside arguing and even in the corridors screaming at each other, to the point where the chief of staff would come out of Congressman Polis's office and say, shh, you know, quiet down. But, I mean, that was the way they engaged each other and came to a deep sort of deep affection and respect for each other.
Of course, one problem that I might point out, I'm talking with Paul Costello, who works directly with young people from Israel and Palestine to seek to resolve some issues, are the outside groups that have their stories about Israel, the outside groups that have their story about Palestine, or have their stories about Arabs, or a story about Muslims, or their story about Jews.
Right.
Obviously, there's been a very destructive story about Jews in in the Western world for a long, long time,
right,
centuries.
Right.
But you have the pressure of those, you might say, alien groups, and that is they don't live there,
right,
they don't come from there,
right,
on those who do live there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's another part of the work we do, and it's a kind of a narrative ethics that we teach, which is, you know, I can tell your story, Deal, but it's really your story to tell, not mine.
Right.
And sometimes, you know, when you allow, if we build a program where you show up in the story I'm telling about you, you no longer are an object. You get a voice and you become a subject. So when these young people from Israel or Palestine are showing up at AIPAC meetings and J Street meetings and all these lobbying groups that so intensely focus and spread a particular version of the Israel-Palestine story, they create quite a shock in some respects because we're talking about Gaza and then suddenly someone from Gaza pops
makes
up
a big difference
and says, you know, talk, that's my story. Why are you telling my story that way? If you don't live there, you're not going to create a life there. How dare you usurp my voice? And that's a very powerful, I think the young people really get a sense that it's their story to tell and witness in a way that holds these groups accountable.
And one problem there is it's not that no one should ever try to explain Gaza publicly. It's that the explanations come so pre-canned, so fabric, you know, they're sort of talking points that have been around for 20, 30 years.
Right.
So I think they're reacting as much to the kind of reductionism of the explanation as they are to someone else involving themselves.
Right.
You've oversimplified. In my trips to the Holy Land since 2004, you know, I just have become more and more aware of the complexities and the sort of subterranean layers that are often hidden from the media talking points of the situation. For example, in Gaza, would the normal person know that its GNP is higher than all of the other part of the West Bank?
Right.
That it's really has worked out a way to have some economic viability in spite of the fact that it's, you know, virtually isolated militarily. They have no right to the sea that they border. They have no right to the air under which they live. It makes very difficult to get in and out of Gaza. They have to have specific permissions from the Israeli government to even leave or return. Yet they have a higher GNP than the whole rest of the West Bank.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, it's thrived in spite of itself, in spite of the situation it's in.
Right. I mean, and I think that's what's remarkable about when you visit these folks that they. Or, I mean, I was visiting Ramallah there in May, and it's just like.
I love Ramallah. I mean, what a vibrant town.
Oh, I mean, I want to go back and get there.
And the best vanilla ice cream in the world.
Yes. It's an amazing place. And the Palestinian people are an amazingly resilient.
They are so happy. You know, it's funny. You go in places like that, and there's nothing but smiling faces.
Exactly.
And it's even true of the worst situations on the West Bank where the wall, they don't want to call it the wall, but the wall has its impact.
Right.
Smiling faces everywhere.
Right. Right. No, I think, you see, when you analyze the stories that are told, they're not actually stories, they're arguments. And that means, you know, you can't allow complexity and you can't allow irony and you certainly, certainly can't allow contradiction. Gaza is either, you know, all Hamas-led and aggressive towards Israel, wanting its obliteration, or it's full of just normal families trying to make a living in a very oppressive situation, oppressed both by the external circumstances and the internal circumstances. I mean, if you want to win an argument, you don't tell the contradictory story. You have to stick to the one. And so I think that's part of...
You can't give any ground, right?
You can't... You know, there's a professor that I met a few months ago who teaches Shakespearean literature in the University of Gaza, and his university has been sort of obliterated, or his classroom has, and he you know, he tries to teach them The Merchant of Venice, his young Garzon students, and, you know.
that is really a guy I'd like to talk to about
and
that.
And he says, you know, when he asks the students who do they identify with, of course they say they identify with Shylock.
Of course.
I mean, you know, it's like he's them. And it's just like, you know, great stories don't allow you the easy option of black and white.
That is a great story.
As in that Shakespeare, even despite himself, creates a human character that really resonates with a sense of reality.
As he did in Othello. And
exactly.
Shakespeare had a way of taking this other, this alien person that or group that you in general dislike or even despise.
Right.
And as you say, making them into a subject, bring out the humanity of them.
And it's the same in the, you know, in the Gospels and the Good Samaritan story. And we saw that. I mean, I'll give you two quick stories, Deal. Last year, very big, strong, he's a lawyer and a boxer from Ramallah, he's Palestinian, who was on the program last year. And I paired him in a host family with a budding politician from Israel, a young political student.
You're naughty. You're naughty.
And the two of them, like, you know, back and forth, arguing. But the young Israeli guy had served in the military as a medical officer. And so they were on the way to a Habitat for Humanity build one hot Sunday morning at the Bethesda Metro. And Nada, the Palestinian, had a kind of an epileptic faint and collapsed down the escalator. And Nayor, who the Israeli was with him, I mean, pulled him out, applied first aid, got the ambulance, got him to hospital, and, you know, almost like saved his life. And that changed everything. It's sort of like, oh, my God, that became the story then, mm-hmm. The touchstone story of the summer, that, like, there's the Good Samaritan, the person who you think is your enemy is the person who saves you.
It's like the soldiers in World War One who got so sick of the slaughter to stop shooting at each other and started sending notes to each other about when they were being ordered to, you know, shoot a 40-pound bomb to the other side. They began to literally say, we've had enough of this. I'm talking with Paul Costello about his work with young people from Israel and from Palestine. He's the founder and executive director of the Center for Narrative Studies in Washington, D.C. We're going to talk some more to him, and I'm going to challenge him. I'm going to pose some difficult questions just after this message.
What is RCIA and why is it so important in the Catholic Church? Hi, I'm Peggy Stanton, and I'm inviting you to join me on Power from the Pews to learn the answer to that question from Bob and Marion Smentowski. They run one of the most successful RCIA programs in Michigan. Join us this Saturday at 11 a.m. and Sunday at 9:30 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio.
On January 12, 2013, Ave Maria Radio held its first conference, Catholic Witness in a Nation Divided. The USCCB's Kevin Appleby and Father Robert Sirico responded to Al Cresta's immigration questions.
They knew in order for them to be able to succeed in business, they had to speak English. And there were no courts where they could go and sue and the ACLU would help them to fight a business because a business wants a receptionist to be able to speak a language properly.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting on the Mind of Christ. Hearing the Church's actual teaching on immigration opened the eyes and hearts of many of the attendees. Listen for yourself on the next Putting on the Mind of Christ. It's heard this and every Sunday afternoon at 3, encoring Saturday afternoons at 6 on 990 WDEO, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Hi, this is Deacon Tom Lowy, Development Director for Ave Maria Radio, letting you know that our fall membership drive is September 8th through the 12th this year. That's the week after Labor Day, and we need volunteers to make this drive successful. If you can spare a couple of hours during any of the days of the drive, that's September 8th through the 12th, give us a call at 877-288-1077 or email our volunteer director, Cheryl, by going to volunteer@avemariaradio.net.
I'm back with Paul Costello talking about the conflict, the ongoing conflict in the Holy Land between Israel and Palestine, which has been punctuated in a terrible way by the recent conflict in Gaza between Israel and Palestine again, that started with the death of three young adult Israelis near the town of Hebron. Paul, I was telling you during the break that on one of my trips to the Holy Land a few years ago, I took the American journalist Robert Novak, who had never been there and was a recent Catholic convert, by the way, and his eyes were just completely opened by visiting on both sides of the fence with Israeli officials, and with civilians and journalists, and with Palestinians. But the one meeting that was the most poignant was a meeting we were invited to with four Israeli generals, some of whom had at one time been in charge of all the security, military security, on the West Bank, which means they were in charge of all the Israeli military forces, as we've already mentioned, usually young people in their late teens, early 20s, men and women who required to serve. And all four of them, their stories had changed. They were telling us that there had to be a two-state solution that had to happen for the sake of the lives of their children and grandchildren.
Right.
I mean, they saw it that the direction that had been, that is still the policy of Israel, is simply one that was going to not be beneficial and probably going to be tragic in the future.
Right.
And I must say that Bob Novak and I were both really surprised that military men, respected, honored military men, would tell the story the way they did. We were completely surprised by it.
Right. Well, one of the films that one or two of the Israeli young people on the program were eager for the whole team to see this summer was a film called The Gatekeepers. I don't know whether you've seen that.
I haven't. No.
It's all the kind of the six or seven former heads of Shin Bet, which is the internal security service, basically saying the same thing, that they just kind of thought that there were tactics and strategy, but no long term purpose to what they were doing, and that it wasn't going to get them where they needed to get in terms of sustaining a long-term Israeli independent state, which we all want and which, you know, the people deserve to have. But I mean, but then equally, the Palestinian people deserve exactly the same. And so I guess, you know, it's interesting, again, as I said to you about the Northern Ireland thing, what are those pivot points when people have had enough, or people have suffered enough, or that the world it basically says, look, enough deaths. Young Israeli soldiers being thrown into urban conflict, which is the most deadly of all, tunnels, going into tunnels, I mean, or enough babies and mothers and children playing soccer on a beach. How many more? How much more? I just think that this is like a turning point here. You sort of hope and you sort of pray that, and I think that's why the young people, I mean, they clung together, because I think they discovered in the end they really have more in common than they have not in common.
I want to pose a question to you based upon something I read this morning. A very distinguished conservative political writer, Thomas Sowell, wrote a column where he's defending the more or less the position of Matt Drudge on his Drudge Report. Drudge has been constantly reminding his readership of the defending, I should say, Israeli action in Gaza that has taken now over 1,000 civilian lives. And Sowell actually wrote this. He said, people are not thinking anymore because they're forgetting the number of casualties that the United States inflicted in World War II on civilians, both in Japan and in Germany, and that so that the number of civilian casualties should be in no way of concern to Americans. I was really startled by that comparison.
Right.
Are you?
In a way, I am, and in a way, I'm not. I mean, I'm the product of a World War II marriage. My mum and my dad, flew in the Air Force out of the Great Britain, and you know. So, I mean, I know that story really, really well. I think the story has changed, though, in a sense that, we can't. You know, when social media allows you to have instantaneous pictures and reports of the damage on the ground, then there is a feedback loop that wasn't possible in World War II. And I think, you know, people, and also with the way technology has changed around pinpoint accuracy and stuff like that. So I don't know. I think the human story has a greater chance of being told now than it used to in World War II. And, you know, I just think if we knew about all the suffering that our actions inflict on others, I think that human beings recoil from that if they know it.
Well, I recoiled when I read this. I mean, it was like he was arguing that the bombing of Dresden and the atomic bombs being dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki was enough to silence our concerns about civilian deaths in Gaza. That's a huge leap. It seems to me that Sol's not the one that's thinking very hard.
No, and I think he needs to talk to a lawyer, a military lawyer, who will tell him about Geneva 1, Geneva 2, and around the rights of prisoners of war, the whole thing that came out as a reflection of World War II, to say that, you know, in the lessons learned, we never wanted to do that again. We never wanted that civilian casualties. There's very certain terms around how to wage a war that at least minimizes the damage. I mean, there's laws now. There's international codes. You can't just... We couldn't do that again. You couldn't get away with that anymore.
But it's being done.
Well, I mean, I think it's being done, but watch for the aftermath. And again, I think, you know, there's so many smart people in that part of the world. As you say, when they lose, when you go to war, you lose your mind and you lose your sense of morality. I mean, it's just, I think it's sort of a biological thing. It's kind of, I don't know, it's that primal threat. And, and civilization has to come in and impinge on that and say, no, you can't do that. Not only just, you know, I mean...
I'm talking with Paul Costello. I want to remind our listeners that you are the founder and director of the Center for Narrative Studies in Washington, D.C. You had great success in your 10 years of work in Northern Ireland, and now you're trying to work through a rather, I think, somewhat thornier problem, if not as historically rooted, between Palestinians and Israelis. Paul, I was on one of my last trips to the Holy Land. I met a young rabbi from California, mm-hmm. who was a political liberal when he moved with his family to Jerusalem, and that he came to Jerusalem, he said, as an advocate for Palestinian rights, for Palestinian security and a two-state solution. Mm-hmm. But having lived through the first 5 years of 2000 through 2005, with the terrorist bombings of buses and so forth in Jerusalem,
right.
That
right.
he had changed his story to become one very much like obviously Netanyahu has, which is our only resource, our only recourse is to military power.
Right. Well, you know, if that's the sort of habitual way of reacting in Gaza 2008, 2012, 2014, is sort of a trigger reaction, and as if to say that if you've only got a hammer, then everything looks like a nail, We talk about Martin Luther King with our students, and like his teaching about how does violence end violence, and how does hatred end hatred, and how does darkness enlighten anybody? It's just the whole question of the logic of it, that you want to stop people killing you, so you want to kill them. Well, just like, as you know, as Gandhi says, an eye for an eye just means we're both blind. And the logic of it is you've got to change the story to sort of say that war is not just wrong, it's stupid, because it doesn't get you what you need. It does in the short term, maybe, but you've got to find a different story around sort of offering the possibility that, you know, people in Gaza can live with human dignity and equality and not hate anybody.
What about the story of justice? I mean, you hear both sides talking about justice, and they link justice to their own acts of violence, that is, their own retribution.
Right.
Is that what justice is?
Well, see, I think the way justice, you know, the Lady Justice has a blindfold, but the principle, it's justice and mercy. One hand is justice and the other hand is mercy. I think the Pope has recently been reading a book by one of the cardinals on mercy, which I think is like justice without mercy is cruelty, and mercy without justice is just permissiveness. I think that we've lost. I take the students in Washington, they come up to New York for a weekend. And, you know, we start at Union Square, and there's the statue of Gandhi there, and we look at the statue of Gandhi on Saturday. On Sunday, it ends at the Bethesda Fountain in Central Park, and we talk about Beth Hesed, which is the place of Hesed. I mean, God in the Old Testament and the New Testament is a God of compassion. Hesed means, you know, merciful love. It's not a juridical thing. I think we've probably, the story of justice is not necessarily the story of there's a bigger story than just an eye for an eye or revenge or equality. I think that's where the whole question about justice loses its way somewhere. And I also we talk about Lincoln. I mean, Lincoln, after the Civil War, he could have enacted justice, but he enacted mercy. He wanted to heal. He wanted to heal a broken nation. Or the same thing in South Africa and the Truth and Reconciliation. I mean, we started a South African program in 2005, 2006. So I just think justice is a story that it's too narrow.
How do you then get people who have been born into and grown up being told or heard or absorbing a certain narrative about them, their own identity, their own ethnicity, their own religion, their own country, and something that's become deeply, deeply part of who they are? How is it even possible for stories to change?
Well, I think that's a really good question, but I think our way is that you don't try and fix the old story. You try and create a future story that has a magnetic power to it. And I guess I always use the example that, you know, most times in human experience, when we fall out of love with somebody, it's because we've fallen in love with somebody else. And so, like, if the debate about Israel and Palestine is stuck in 1948 or 1967, trying to right the wrongs of history, that's futile. But if you imagine that Israel and Palestine has the most ingenious people on one side and the most industrious people on the other, and in terms of just oil deposits, technological possibilities, seaports, openness to the world, my goodness, that place could become what now Belfast has become. You know, Belfast, go to Belfast in Northern Ireland, and it's one of the really interesting European cities with its bars and its nightclubs and its...
I've been there. I agree with you.
So, I mean, 30 years ago, it was, you know, people were too...
You wouldn't want to get close to it.
Yeah. So I think it's a... Part of this is an act of the imagination. And so that's part of, you know, we have a young artist on our program this year, and he lives in Dahisha refugee camp, the place the Pope visited there in May. He's a wonderful artist. His project for change, which they all have to do, is to create a series of posters, and it'll imagine what Palestine will look like in 2050. And the war will just be a memory. It'll be consigned to a World War II museum that we go visit. And he's got posters saying, this is what it could be. This is what I want it to be. He has a picture of a Palestinian family picnicking on a green, grassy hill. And behind it is the ruins of a checkpoint with a little plaque that says, you know, back in the early part of this century, Our people didn't quite get on with each other, you know.
I'm talking with Paul Costello about his narrative therapy, and I think you just said something very profound, if you don't mind me putting it that way. Don't try to fix the old story. I think a lot of the negotiations that have gone on, a lot of the public discussion has been precisely that.
Right.
And it never gets anywhere.
Right, right. I mean, I think I try to tell the young people the decisions that they make now are going to be more shaping of the future that they want than any decisions made before now. Because now is the only time you can make the decision. And the future is the only thing that remains open. And, you know, if you are infected with a story which says to you you can't change anything, or that the present is just the product of the past rather than the prologue to the future. So there's the shift. If the present is the prologue to a future, then I can act and I can choose. If the present is just the product of the past, I'm stuck in repeating the same old pattern. And that's what I see. We bombed Gaza in 2008. We bombed it in 2012. We bombed it in 2014. Like, what, you know, it's like, that's just the past repeating itself. And it's just so obvious and it's so futile. So, I mean, I think it's not just about a ceasefires. It's about a reimagination.
By the way, you know, on my trip to the Holy Land, Paul, I found a lot, you know, more Israelis than not wanted to resolve the conflict.
Absolutely.
And I would talk to the top, politicians, the top journalists there, and I'd constantly find deep sympathy with people like yourself who are trying to find peace, you know, or help to, you know, resolve the conflict, which seems to be a fact that a lot of Americans don't know anything about. They don't realize the public position on the issue of two-state solution, which is very, very popular.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I think politics has sort of got divorced from the personal consequences of the political decisions. And somehow we've got to kind of remarry those two somehow. And I think, you know, our program, we're a little program with a big idea. You know, as far as what happens back in the region, you know, we don't know whether there's much in the short term we can do. But we think even in the short term we can help change the conversation in Washington.
When are you going to have a program for Republicans and Democrats?
yes. Indeed. Oh, well, that's on my agenda when the presidential election takes up.
It's really gotten that ridiculous. And
yes,
I came to Washington 20 years ago and things have just gotten worse and worse and worse when it comes to civility,
right,
you know, basic
right.
and trust.
Right.
And it's become almost impossible to move the ball down the field because nobody seems to want to work together.
Well, I think part of it is no one's listening to each other. That people are just they've lost the art of that. You know that the leadership is not just an expressive competency; it's also a communication competency. And it's not what you say, but how you get heard. And whether it's about healthcare reform or immigration reform, it seems like the people who shout the loudest are the ones that drown out anyone trying to create a real constructive conversation. And so, I mean, it's a big part of our program is teaching people how to listen and teaching people how to tell a story in such a way that they invite someone to come inside and listen. But I give you just the other story I wanted to share, which was very touching, like the Good Samaritan story this year. So one of the young lads from Israel, I mean, he arrived here a couple of weeks and discovered that his romantic partner back in the region, you know, it was off. The romance was finished after 2 years. And he was just in depression, you know, absolutely kind of didn't know what to do. And he called his friends at home, and like they were like the good friends of Job in the book of Job, basically. You know, like, get over it, sort of.
Right, right.
We could see that coming, you know, this wasn't meant to be. So, I mean, some of the so he's an Israeli young guy, and this is the Palestinian girls. He walks into a seminar, and Karma's the Palestinian girl from Ramallah, and says, you know, what's the matter? And he says, he bursts into tears. So Karma kind of hugs him close and calls Nisreen, who's from Gaza, whose parents any day could be killed. Nisreen comes over. So Nisreen and Karma are the kind of consolation committee for Daniel. And they take him out and say, listen, we're going out to a nightclub tonight. You know, well, you've got to find somebody else. And, like, it was a transformative experience for him, for young Daniel. Like, he gave a fantastic speech about a week and a half ago, talking about it taught him the difference between sympathy and empathy. And he said, you know, and he had a ring that his partner had, you know, had given him. And he was going to throw it into the Potomac, he said. But he said, no, he said, so he called out Karma at the speech, and he said, Karma, you know, this ring is my broken romance, you know, and it represents just so much suffering to me. But it's my story that you stepped inside of and you heard. So that's what I want to do for you. I'm not going to give this ring, throw it away. I'm going to give it to you. I want you to wear it. And it's my pledge to you to say, just as you stepped inside my story, I pledge I want to step inside your story and the story of suffering of the Palestinian people. Well, I mean, it's just like, wow.
Wow, that's wonderful.
Does
this have the kind of impact on the audience that I think it ought to have?
They just haven't stopped talking about this ring. And, you know, and Karma hasn't taken the ring off since that night.
I take it empathy is better than sympathy?
Well, I think he was making that point to say that sympathy is from the outside in, and empathy is stepping inside someone else's story and listening to it as they hear it. And that was the difference, that you know, Israelis and Palestinians on our kind of program, when they deeply listen to each other's story, then they understand that the horizons of empathy are infinite. I mean, and that's probably, you know, what we kind of believe about the Jewish God or the Christian God or the Muslim God, that, you know, God forgives all because he knows all. You know, he's inside every story. So I think that's kind of, it was a deeply moving moment, but it sort of was symbolic of what NSL is trying to do with these young people.
You said several times, it's not what you say, but how you are heard. That strikes me as very, very true. And it also strikes me that most people pay attention only to what they say.
Right.
Not how they are heard.
Right.
How do you get a grip on how you're heard? And how do you deal with that?
Well, I think we create before any event, we create a kind of a listening laboratory where people test out their stories on the audience and the audience give them feedback. And in a contentious issue like a conflict, you know, if, say, you know, the Israelis want to get up and talk about the terrorists and use very strong denunciations, that then the Palestinians are going to say, hang on, I've switched off. I'm angry at you. I'm not listening to you. Or if the Palestinians get up and want to be very strong about the Israelis and talk about the killing machine and all these other terms, and then the audience to say, look, I want to argue with you now. I don't want to listen to you. And then you have to put the question to the speaker. You're a leader. You've got to use your skills to be heard. And you can say the same thing, but you say it in a way that can be heard and doesn't provoke and doesn't create a barrier. So that becomes the real challenge.
Well, what about this whole issue I hear when people say, well, but it's the truth, it's the truth?
Well, I think that's when people then confuse expressive competency with communicative competency. And expressive competency is, it's good to say to people how you feel, but you can tell that to your friends or to your therapist or to your priest. This is how I feel. Okay, good. This is how I feel. Good, that's about you. But an act of leadership is you have a focus that you want the people to feel something. So, you know, it's not what you feel. It's what you want your audience
that's
to feel.
Very, very important. And I must say that
The choice of words, the images, the story you
speak. The posture, the tone of voice.
Absolutely.
Look on your face. This is what Pope Francis, I think, is helping Catholics with right now. And I want to thank you, Paul Costello, founder and director of the Center for Narrative Studies. You've been a wonderful guest, and we hope you'll come back sometime.
Thank you, Deal. It's been a wonderful conversation, and good luck to all your great work with Ave Maria, and I hope we continue this conversation.
We will. Soon. We will. Paul Costello, thank you for being on the show.
As we close, I want to thank each of you for listening. I hope you found it as enjoyable as I have in bringing it to you. Join me again next week on Church and Culture, brought to you by Ave Maria Radio.
If you have any comments or questions about Church and Culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.